Good evening. Good evening, I'm Susie Hall and I'm based at LSE Cities and the Department of Sociology at the London School of Economics. It's a total pleasure to welcome Emma Jackson from Goldsmiths University and Suzanne Wessendorf from the Iris Centre at the University of Birmingham. This evening, Emma and Suzanne's books are brought into a conversation on new urban diversities from a London perspective. We introduce two significant and compelling books, Young Homeless People, Fixed in Mobility by Emma Jackson, and Commonplace Diversity, Social Relationships in a Super Diverse Context by Suzanne Wessendorf. Unfortunately, because of the kind of strictures of UK publishing, we're unable to sell the books at an affordable price tonight. But having read both books, I strongly encourage you to either get your libraries to buy them or to go and take them out from your libraries. They're a fantastic read. Each author is going to briefly present their books, and then we'll open to the floor for questions and discussion. And the hashtag for this evening's event is Urban Diversity. By way of introduction to the conversation between these two books, I'd like to briefly reflect on how the authors engage with critical urban ethnography and how they both challenge and expand on Vertebeck's notion of superdiversity. Vertebeck developed the notion of superdiversity in 2007 to scrutinize more carefully the multiple and accelerated aspects of diversity emerging in a world which is more mobile, more unequal, and in which increasingly the regulations around migration are becoming elaborate and impenetrable. Suzanne's ethnography begins with the elemental question of how to write about social groups. Her process of participant observation is underscored by her own residency in Hackney, and over a period of 18 months, she engages in varied places of mixing, from knitting classes to meetings on social housing estates, to hanging out in parks. Suzanne writes about social groups through their social realms, and it's from this vantage point that we begin to learn of the highly variegated, largely uncontested, and often simultaneous practices of both living together and living apart. Emma's ethnography of young homeless people emerges from her experiences as a volunteer worker in a day center. And a key question that Emma raises is how to write about people in distress. A remarkable achievement in this ethnography is the full and uncompromised portrayal of individuals. Emma writes what I would describe as a warts and all composition of individual lives and circumstances, making for an acute and wonderful book, notable for both its unromantic and unmoralizing perspectives. A key theoretical engagement in Emma's book is to introduce both class and space into the expanding but not always critical sphere of superdiversity. Emma's intersection between superdiversity and inequality is developed through her scrutiny of dislocation. She explores how young homeless people gather up a sense of themselves through, for example, the making and sticking with their routines. Through this ethnography of young homeless routines, we also learn of the increased vigilance of the state, coupled with the brutal diminishment of public resources. In Suzanne's book, she explores the implications of the density and proximity of bodies all converged in place. In her acclaimed and intelligent book, Suzanne develops a vocabulary at the opposite spectrum to the superlative of superdiversity. She reveals what she calls a lacking in drama sociability, or even an arm's length conviviality, showing the spectrum of social life from the intersections of difference in public space to the retreat to more segregated private worlds. Please join me in welcoming both Emma and Suzanne.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Susie, for this generous introduction and also for inviting us to launch our books here at the LSE. It's a real honour to be here and to see so many people here. Thanks a lot. So this book, it's about the London Borough of Hackney, which I have described as super diverse. And of course, there's many other areas of London which are similarly super diverse and comparable with Hackney. Now, super diversity, as Susie has already mentioned, refers to diversity not just in terms of ethnicity and migration backgrounds, but also different variables like class, socioeconomic backgrounds, religions, legal statuses, disability, sexual orientation, etc., and all of these variables coming together in specific urban areas. Now, Hackney... In Hackney, you don't just have different nationalities and people from of different ethnic backgrounds, but of all these other variables as well. So people have different migration histories, different reasons for coming to London, different legal statuses, different religions, etc. Now, I'm not going to go into the statistics here, but this is countries of origin, and it's just to visualise the kind of diversity you can find there. So the questions the project asked is how people in such a place get along. What kinds of social relations do they form across differences? And what kinds of attitudes do they form towards people who are different? Now, I did ethnographic fieldwork for about 18 months, but I had been living in the area for about 3 years already when I started the project. And in the meantime, it's been about 10 years. And I've also had two children during the project, which enabled me to participate in various family-related activities and sort of give me an insight into the area from that point of view. And during the 18 months, I hung out in different associations, like a knitting group for elderly women and a youth club on an estate, a parents' group in a school, etc. I did observations in public spaces like parks and streets and markets, and I undertook interviews and had lots of conversations with local people. Now, for the analysis of my data, I found it really useful to draw on the sociologist Lynn Loughlin's concept of the public, parochial, and the private realm. Now, the public and the private realm are probably clear to all of you, but with the parochial realm, she refers to kind of semi-public spaces like associations, clubs, relations between neighbours, schools, institutions. So spaces where people have sort of more routine relations and meet on a more regular basis. Now, in a nutshell, I have found that in the public and the parochial realm, people mix across different types of differences a great deal, and they are generally positive social relations. But when it comes to social relations in the private realm, there are divisions along mainly socioeconomic and ethnic lines. Sorry. And people often don't mix. Most people don't see this as a problem, though. Now, of course, I'm here talking about general patterns, and of course there are examples of inter-class or inter-ethnic marriages or friendships, but these are usually the exception rather than the norm. Now, one of the surprises I met at the beginning of the research was that people didn't experience Hackney's diversity as something particularly unusual. So I found myself doing research about something that people didn't think was a big deal. For example, when I asked whether I could do part of my fieldwork in an IT club for elderly people, the teacher of the club welcomed me there, but he also said that although his students came from many different places, diversity was not really an issue in any of their conversations. He told me that they don't really ask each other where they come from, and they don't seem to be very interested in the other students' origins because almost everybody came from elsewhere, and it was therefore not a particularly unusual or interesting topic to talk about. So in other words, diversity is so normal among the students in this computer club that it has somewhat become unnoticeable. And this normality of diversity is what I have described as commonplace diversity. Now, commonplace diversity, of course, grounds in the long history of immigration-related diversification of the area since the Second World War. And But importantly, I have to say that despite this commonplace diversity, prejudice and stereotypes might still exist, but they are very rarely acted out in public, and people generally behave with civility towards people who are different. So we have this strange disjuncture between an exceptional demographic reality of kind of extreme diversity and, on the other hand, everyday experiences of diversity, where diversity is seen as something quite normal and banal. Now, what I noticed in many of the conversations I had during my research is that there's something like an ethos of mixing in Hackney. And with this, I mean that people expect others to mix across differences. And this came out most clearly when people spoke about groups which they perceived did not want to mix. Now, Orthodox Jews and hipsters were mentioned most often as groups who do not participate in mixed spaces and who don't want to mix. And this was generally portrayed as something negative. Now, these perceptions are also shaped by issues about, for example, contestations over space. So, for example, there has been a dispute over a pub in Stamford Hill, which is the Orthodox Jewish area, and the pub was called the Swan. And it was bought by Orthodox Jews and was going to be turned into a synagogue. And, of course, the pubgoers felt pushed out. And in their campaign to save the pub, they emphasized how it used to be a place for people of all kinds of different backgrounds, and that it was now going to be used by just one group. Now, the fact that the pub had been used by people of different ethnicities, but also different sexual orientations, was described by the pub goers as typical for Hackney. And in contrast, the use of the pub by just one group was seen as non-typical. Now, similarly, the hipsters are often criticized for taking over a local park, namely London Fields, and the surrounding streets, for being inconsiderate of local residents and for leaving rubbish everywhere and also for holding parties in quiet neighborhood streets. So the perceptions about these groups are also shaped by such tensions about the use of public space, about cleanliness and order. Now, it's interesting to contrast these two groups with two other groups, like Turkish speakers and Vietnamese people. And many members of these groups spend a lot of time with people of the same background who speak the same language. And of course, I'm not generalizing here. Of course, there are exceptions, but this is sort of the general pattern. And it was interesting during the research to hear how other Hackney residents described these groups. They said that they just get on with it. And in relation to Vietnamese people, they said that they are kind of invisible. However, they did not criticize them for not mixing. And this is because both Vietnamese people and Turkish speakers have, for example, shops and restaurants which cater to everybody. And they also send their children to state schools. So there are many places that kind of serve as bridges between them and other people, and they are therefore seen as an integral part of Hackney's population. And this is not the case for hipsters and Orthodox Jews, who are perceived to want to stay away from the rest of the population. Now, of course, I need to emphasize, I'm not here talking about the characteristics of these groups as such, but I'm talking about how they are perceived by the rest of the population. Now I'm just going to move on to another part of the book, the riots, which happened in 2011, and that was in the middle of my fieldwork. And of course, although it was quite scary, it was interesting to see how the riots were explained in the aftermath. Now, I'm sure many of you are familiar with the various explanations for the riots discussed by both academics, especially here at the LSE, and in the media. And these include, for example, cuts in youth services, resentment against the government because of the expenses scandal, stop and search activities by the police, and growing inequality. But what was almost more interesting was that after the riots, much of the media emphasized that all kinds of different people participated in the riots. But in Hackney, many people actually interpreted the riots along racial lines, emphasizing that the reasons why black people were involved in the riots was that they were the most discontent and disadvantaged, and that they were fed up with bad treatment by the police. So in some ways, after the riots, the most important divisions in Hackney came to the fore. And these are between young black people and the rest of the population. And in fact, there's a long history of police violence against black youngsters in Hackney and, of course, beyond, and also of stereotypes among residents. And this particularly applies to young black male youngsters hanging out in public space. They're often seen as intimidating and as threatening, also among the parental generation. So stereotypes about black youngsters in the area are not based on an overarching existence of racism as such, but they are specifically related to ideas of black youth and delinquency. So while I have found that diversity in Hackney is commonplace and that people are very accepting of various types of differences, I also found that this one group does not really fit into this picture of commonplace diversity because of long-standing inequality, disadvantage, and continuing racism. Now, all in all, the picture of diversity in Hackney is quite positive. People are used to being surrounded by people who are different, and they behave with civility towards each other. And even if most people seek friends who are similar to them, they do mix in public space and in associations and public institutions. None of the people who participated in my research saw it as a problem that people then go home separately. And in fact, it was almost an unspoken, taken-for-granted fact. Now, I think it's important to look at contexts where diversity is the norm and not the exception, especially in an age of talk about Britishness and cohesion in the context of the UK. Greg Noble, a sociologist from Australia who has done some similar work in Sydney, he also talks about unpanicked multiculturalism, and I think that that's very much what is happening in Hackney. Now, places like Hackney can tell us something about how people skillfully manage to live with diversity in day-to-day life, and while keeping the existence of stereotypes and prejudice in mind, I think it's also important to recognize these skills and to look at contexts where diversity really isn't the main problem. Now, the place which Emma Jackson researched is exactly such a place where diversity is not the main issue, but where at the same time it is negotiated on a daily basis. And what I found really interesting when reading Emma's book is that she zoomed into one of these parochial spaces, namely a day centre for young homeless people, and she looked at what was happening there. And of course, in relation to my own work, I was particularly interested in the role of the role that the day centre plays for the formation of social relations amongst the youngsters and how they experience diversity in this place. And just like I have observed in Hackney, Emma describes the coexistence of both linkages and divisions among the visitors to the centre. And the linkages go along lines of language, for example, and there are divisions between born British and migrants. Now, diversity is commonplace in that space, in that people who visit the day centre are of many different class, educational, ethnic, and national backgrounds. But I found it fascinating how Emma also illustrates that commonplace diversity cannot be taken for granted. It's something that has to be learned over time. People have to get used to it. And she exemplifies this with Kirsty, a young woman who comes from a small industrial white working class town in Northern England. And Kirsty is first frightened of the different others whom she encounters at the day centre, but she's making an effort to be open. And this is very different to the born Londoners, who are more at ease with diversity. One of her informants says that London is multicultured, referring to multiculturalism as a fact of life, or in other words, as commonplace. But at the same time, they continue to have stereotypical views of other groups. Now, I want to end with the notion of mobility and locality in the city, which I think links Emma's and my book quite nicely. Neighborhood studies like mine are sometimes criticized for kind of evoking an image of people being and remaining local. But a place like Hackney, and of course most London boroughs, is very much shaped by the transnational relations that people maintain with their countries of origin. And these transnational influences form the kind of background or wallpaper behind the local lives of the residents, and they form part of the commonplace diversity that I described. At the same time, however, I found that people who grew up in Hackney or who have lived there for a long time, they are indeed very much rooted in the area. And this comes out very strongly in Emma's book, where she describes how some of the young Londoners that she interviewed felt displaced from their local area when they moved to the hostel in central London. And she shows how many of these young people lack the choice to be and live where they wish to. And this is an issue that has also come out in my project, where choice of where to live is most often left to the wealthier residents, also for those with highly transnational backgrounds. And I think this tension between lives which both take place within these transnational contexts, but which are at the same time firmly rooted within specific areas, whether by choice or not, I think that this is really interesting. And I wonder if it's something particular about big and super diverse cities like London. And I think I'll leave it at that and hand over to Emma. Yeah. Thank you. And there are some discount book flyers floating around, so just in case.
The discount book flyers, but it will still cost you about the same as an expensive pair of trousers. You might find it unusual that a book about homelessness is being presented at an event about urban diversities. This theme wasn't on my mind when I embarked on this research. This is an ethnography of a day centre for young homeless people in central London, but it became very important to my thinking. Through the process of doing this research, I became convinced that an examination of homeless places can enrich our understanding of new urban diversities, and also conversely, that studies of homelessness can be enriched by engaging with exploring forms of global mobility and differential immigration status that are increasingly impacting on homeless spaces and are often overlooked in homeless research. So those two points will underpin my discussion today. Now, I got into being interested in homeless experiences of the city through working on a different project which chronicled the displacement of crime in the King's Cross area. There was a massive drive to clean up King's Cross area before the Eurostar arrived. Drugs markets and sex markets were displaced, and homeless people got caught up in this process also. And I was involved as a research assistant on this project, and I was going into hostels and interviewing people about their experience of the city. And it was very intense time. There was dust blowing in from all of the construction work that was happening in the King's Cross area while I was talking to these people about their lives that were becoming more and more constrained in public space. And this got me really interested in homelessness in the city. At the time, I was thinking a lot with those critical geographers that deal with homelessness, Neil Smith, thinking about the rights to the city and all of that. When I arrived at the day centre, what I found complicated both the picture of homelessness that I'd got from working with this older homeless population who were predominantly white, usually English, Irish, Scottish. And it also complicated some of my thinking around the theories that I was using. So I was faced with quite a different population. I'm just going to read a little bit about the picture of homelessness that comes out of the day centre. So in the day centre, a picture of homelessness emerges that is not captured by a look around the cleaned up streets of central London. Here the hidden homeless, hostel residents and sofa surfers become visible. Even the most cursory of glances at this day centre, or more pertinently, a cursory listen, would reveal that this is what Vertovec terms a super diverse group of people. And I go on to sketch out and describe the voices that can be heard in the day centre, which include Irish, Yorkshire, South London Cockney, Scottish peppered with London street slang, Tigrinya and Amharic, which are Eritrean and Ethiopian languages, and Somali. The particular combination of voices speaks of a particular location, London, and also of a time. The main body of this research was carried out between 2007 and 2009, when, for example, more Eritrean and Ethiopian people were using the service than they are now. So the composition of people in the day centre is constantly changing. World events, as well as more local struggles and national issues, impact on who happens to be playing table tennis in a homeless day centre in London at any one time. So I wanted to foreground that audio picture of the day centre because I think you get a sense of the diversity of the young people, but also the sense that these are lives in progress. People do inhabit and live in categories of nationality, ethnicity, and that impacts on how they are treated and how they fare in the homeless system. And I'll go on to talk about that more. But I also want to use the example of the voices to point towards processes of becoming. So the Scottish accent peppered with London street slang. In the day centre, you hear the acquisition of what researchers have called multicultural London English. So urban diversity isn't just about one-off encounters between bodies in the moment, but about what Stuart Hall calls multicultural drift and these processes of becoming. So the subtitle of my book is Fixed Immobility. This is in part about the journeys taken by the young homeless people that are represented in those voices, but there's also an everyday grinding mobility in the lives of young homeless people. The need to get from A to B to access services, to move between couches and various friends' houses, keeping on the move on the street to stay safe. Some of you might have seen in the news recently, there was a homeless charity that got in the newspapers by sharing publicly that they were giving out bus tickets to keep young homeless people off the streets at night. And this fits my idea of being fixed in mobility, staying on the buses to keep safe, which was that was a familiar tactic. As part of my research, I did a mapping exercise, sort of which you can see there, whereby I asked young people to draw their London. And what became really obvious was the importance of routes through the city, particularly buses. And in the book, I argue that being kept on the move like this is a form of violence. It's absolutely exhausting, and it keeps young people suspended in the present and unable to make a leap out and to access a different kind of future. But these mobile lives do have points of stopping off, and the day centre is one of them. You can maybe see on here, that's a little drawing, an idealised house representing a hostel. The day centre is one of these places of stopping off. For those going into the homeless system, there's lots of new, difficult experiences to be managed, of going into a hostel for the first time, for example. But there's also the issue of dealing with differences of race, ethnicity, religion, nationality, sexuality on a day-to-day basis in a situation where there's very little of that private realm that Suzanne was talking about. So as a diverse space then, the day centre becomes embroiled in discussions of difference. And the kinds of encounters that are found here in some ways recall other studies of young Londoners. So some of you might be familiar with Les Back's work on new ethnicities, where he finds that dueling play characterises interactions between young people, where race, ethnicity, as well as shade, nationality, sexuality, where in London you're from, can all be drawn upon in this sort of bantering interaction. But in my case, I think in order to make sense of these kinds of interactions and the distinctions young people make between each other, they need to be understood as taking place in this space of homelessness. And I just want to give you a couple of examples very briefly. So the first is a discussion that happened on New Year's Eve between Zula and Ahmed that arises while they're half playing cards, half watching a film on the TV. And Zula, who is British-born of Eritrean heritage, says to a friend, Ahmed, "Oh, you didn't get films like this in Somalia, did you?" I won't read out the ensuing discussion, but in the ensuing discussion, Zula refuses Ahmed's appeals to similarity based on their African heritage through the forms of skin colour and language. At the same time as making these outreaches, Ahmed positions himself as European, Italian-speaking, with no memory of Somalia. I think there's a complicated negotiation going on here about migration, authenticity, Africanness, Britishness, sameness and difference. But what I want to highlight here is that the young people in the centre are in a particularly precarious position. In the context of this place, to claim I was born here is a way of distinguishing yourself as belonging and a way of distinguishing herself from the more recent wave of Eritrean refugees in the centre. The second example comes from Andrew, and I'm sorry, this is too much text for a PowerPoint, really. Just skim it. He's keen to align himself with Cockney as a culture, and he uses the language of multiculturalism, telling me it's one of the diversities of who I am. Now, I doubt whether in a different situation Andrew would talk about diversities in quite this same way. The dissonances between everyday expressions of difference and the language of multiculture are noticeable. So Andrew uses the language of multiculturalism to reclaim a version of local working class whiteness as something to be proud of. There's all kinds of other things about linking this to changes in the class landscape of London, the replacing of pubs. He talks of the shrinking of space when he says, before you'd see people like me. He also talks about the hybridisation of youth culture. But there are also threads and hints in Andrew's story that complicate this discourse of straightforward Cockney Englishness. He describes Cockney as a breed, but he also acknowledges that this isn't straightforward. He has to stop himself to acknowledge that he's a Cockney Scot. But it isn't just Andrew's self-narration that starts to unravel this combination of Englishness, whiteness and Cockney. Once his words are transcribed, and it's worth thinking about what we do with people's voices when we reduce them to this, they may convey this white Cockney identity, but in the interview, Andrew uses words that are part of London street slang spoken by most of the young people in the centre. And to my ears, I can hear in Andrew's voice the inflections of growing up in a multicultural city, the W sound in boy, things like that. So I want to move on to talk about another important aspect of this. So beyond this everyday life and dynamics of the day centre, the legacies of different forms of dislocation and mobility impact upon a person's position in the homeless system and what they can access. So while spaces of homelessness are becoming increasingly global and complex, at the same time, the system that is in place to accommodate them is increasingly locally oriented. And I just want to briefly give two examples of how this manifests. The first is the position of those with no recourse to public funds. So if you are in the country and because of your migration status, you're not entitled to benefits, the situation is really bleak for you as a young homeless person. The hostels that the day centre refer people into rely on people being entitled to housing benefit. And if you can't access those benefits, you have to rely on another host of the voluntary sector, cold weather shelters, soup kitchens, that kind of thing. And I saw this playing out very harshly in the lives of young homeless people while I was doing the research. The second example is the policy of local connection. As places of homelessness are becoming more diverse, there's also this increasing emphasis on the local within the current institutional network, as exemplified in this policy of local connection. Now, this used to just apply to social housing, so those with a local connection could be classified as priority need, but this has been rolled out to hostels, so now beds are ring-fenced for those with a local connection to a particular London borough. So there's a major disjuncture going on here between this philosophy of local provision and the realities of these diverse spaces of homelessness and the mobile lives of those who use them. So just to conclude the section on my book. So the day centre is this diverse urban constellation, and it provides a different kind of perspective on a city by movement. And when we think about new urban diversities, we might think about market streets more than we think about homeless drop-ins. But I think places like day centres can enrich our understanding of urban diversity. They provide a glimpse of the world city from below, where new arrivals mingle with those who call London home, but who may be estranged from their particular area. And framing the homeless day centre in this way, it's not just about complicating this prevailing picture of homeless spaces in London as populated by white British people, but it also provides a necessary addition to discussions of encounter and difference. People, sometimes complex and diverse urban spaces are not populated by people who are there to dabble in difference. They're there because they need to be. And I think places of homelessness foreground some of the power relations and conflict that undergird super diverse places. So to borrow from Bauman's terminology. This is a diverse space constituted by those not in charge of their movement or whose options are severely constrained, the figure of the vagabond rather than the figure of the tourist. The Homeless Centre also provides an opportunity to examine how diverse spaces intersect with and are shaped by specific forms of governance and welfare. And it provides a way for thinking through what Doreen Massey calls the power geometry of the city, in providing an example of how urban diverse spaces, particularly those that are populated by marginalised people, are tied to forms of governance which has an impact on exclusion and inclusion. The persistence of borders, as manifested in the right to move, access to the welfare state and to accommodation, order homeless experiences within the city. So I'm just going to offer some linking thoughts to Suzanne's talk and throw out some ideas for discussion. I think there's a political and sociological value of stressing that, and I'm paraphrasing and changing Raymond Williams here, that multiculture is ordinary. I think I find such a dissonance between what I heard Theresa May saying the other day in a speech at Tory party conference and the experience I have every day of travelling through South East London on the train. I think it's worth reiterating this, and I think Suzanne's book does this. It also raises questions about encounter. Does it matter if people who are different to each other don't interact beyond the corner shop? How can we talk about encounter without either moralising about what constitutes meaningful encounter or else ossifying people into types like hard pieces of a mosaic? And I was thinking about the difference between a diversified diversity and this idea of multicultural drift. Maybe the two things are happening at the same time. So for me, multicultural drift is not just about the proliferation of categories, but also the reworking of particular localities. And I was thinking about work, you know, Doreen Massey's famous essay on the global sense of place, or more recently, my colleague from Goldsmiths, Alex Riggs Taylor's work, that traces how flows of people and tastes and things remake the local. So it's not just a case of more and more difference, but this remaking of the local, and from that, new emerging flavours and cultures can happen. In Suzanne's book, she writes about how young black people are not incorporated into this happy diversity story and experience racism. And this highlights how racism and commonplace diversity coexist. I think this is really important because I think something that needs to be guarded against is that through the language of super diversity, all difference and all resentments can be made to be sound to be equivalent. So when we write about urban diversities, we need to be attentive to power and the weight of histories of racism. Two more points, I'm going on a bit. Right, gentrification. I want to talk a little bit about gentrification and how that impacts on these things. So Suzanne writes about the erosion of places that constitute the parochial realm. Youth services through government cuts, the post office, the fish and chip shops. So the encounters that are described in her book are taking place on this shifting ground. And I think it's really important to make those links between how the ground is shifting and what that does to encounters. This isn't just about the presence of hipsters, but also about powerful actors that have a role here in shaping the city, developers, planners, the work of councils. Lastly, I was interested by that use of unpanicked multiculturalism, and it's important to point that out, especially given, as I said, government rhetoric on these things. And I just wanted to throw out here as a question to you about this, on the one hand, unpanicked multiculturalism and these very panicked messages that are coming through the media and political discourse. I've been doing some research with Hannah Jones, who's here, and others on those go-home vans. What do those kind of interventions do to unpanicked multiculturalism? What does it do to unpanicked multiculture when people, my Canadian friend was asked for ID when she went to hospital the other day. What does this do, and what does resistance do? Resistance to this do in terms of creating or reaffirming forms of belonging. So that's some things I was thinking about.
Thank
be great to open to the floor for either comments or questions. I think we'll take two at a time, and if you can just say who you are and where you're from before you ask your question, that would be great. So, any starters?
I'm going to have to be cooking for some time, I think.
Probably articulated this in my head yet. Hannah Jones from the University of Warwick. Thanks for the talks and forward to getting the books out of the library. I was thinking about Emma's talk really kind of ran down to the questions around power and diversity in cities and how those young people negotiate those questions and the ways they're excluded and included through different kinds of diversity and mobility. And Suzanne said something about skills at negotiating super diversity. My question, I guess, is mainly to Suzanne, but how are those skills partly about just skills at reinforcing existing structures of power? You know, if we can go, okay, we've got skills, we can all get along, is that about reinforcing and dumping down racist and classist structures? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm.
No, I think it's more banal than that. Oh, actually, I'll be taking two questions.
Is there another? Yeah, one more question. Okay.
Thank you. My name is Paul McGraw. I work with the Catholic Workers Group. I spend most of my life in Hackney. We do Sunday dinners at Laura Clapton for 40 people. But if you could say a word about gentrification, and would you agree that it's much more, it's not simple, it's quite complex. For instance, on Saturday, there's an anarchist book fair at the new Central St. Martin's. So just taking King's Cross, can you possibly argue that it's not for the better, the way the King's Cross has changed? And Clapton has changed that. The people who have lived there for a long time, it is changing, there's no doubt about it, and the hipsters are moving in. But on balance, is gentrification an improvement?
Yeah, I think it depends how you define gentrification. I think there's a problem with thinking, for me, gentrification is fundamentally about the displacement of existing residents. And so if you take that understanding of gentrification, I don't think it is a good thing. If you think of it as, but it is an ambivalent process in terms of urban change, if we think of urban change more generally, so there may be cleaner streets and things like this, more resources being put into the area to serve the new population. There's a brilliant book by Kirsten Payton on Glasgow called Gentrification, A Working Class Perspective, and she writes very well about this ambivalence of living with of how working class people experience gentrification. So yes, they might enjoy some of the new resources, but ultimately if gentrification means you're pushed out of your area, then no.
I'll just add to this and then I'll answer Hannah's question. It's a complicated picture with gentrification because it's not just, the bad white British working class people moving over from West London. Middle class people. It's not that picture, the classic sort of image of gentrification, but actually a lot of these gentrifiers are very diverse themselves. A lot of them come from many different countries. A lot of them aren't necessarily that rich, but they have, high cultural capital in terms of their educational backgrounds, and they just about manage to make it, but they are perceived as the gentrifiers. And in terms of how people on the ground who've been there for a long time experiences, there was very mixed statements about it among poorer people. Some of them said it's good because the area has come up, the schools have gotten better, etc. And then, of course, others have been pushed out. And I almost feel like I need to actually leave Hackney and go to the areas where the people have been pushed out to and talk to these people there, because those who have stayed are the ones who kind of might still be poor but can benefit from the good aspects of gentrification.
I think as well, we're not just talking about, Ruth Glass's idea of gentrification, of the middle classes coming in and doing up their houses. That isn't the only thing that's going on in London right now, the knocking down of social housing and selling off land to developers, all these processes, that's part of the story.
And just one more thing. I've had a lot of people, middle-class people, talk about their children not being able to afford to stay in Hackney. So it's not just the working classes who are being pushed out, but actually it's beyond that, you know. In terms of skills reinforcing existing structures of power, I was more talking about these everyday skills on the street, so in terms of how people communicate across differences. And I've got some examples in the book about, for example, traders at markets or in shops who address their customers according to their backgrounds. You know, say, hi auntie when an Asian lady arrives, and then hi broth when a black guy arrives, and hi madam when I arrive, and stuff like that. So people sort of, and also people being very skilled in communicating across language barriers. And I found, I don't think that's something you can take for granted. And one of my, I'm currently working on a new project looking at more recent migrants in Hackney. And one of my Latin American informants said that she finds it really easy to get around in Hackney and London more generally because everybody speaks bad English and it's okay. So people don't think you're a foreigner just because you speak bad English. You still can kind of belong and be part of the picture. So, yeah.
Banal, but I was actually thinking about those banal interactions in that piece about the market traders, example of being, and you talked about politeness and there being perhaps there are racist ideas, but they're not
acted out.
Glossed over. So maybe those skills are glossing over in everyday life some of the kind of structures of power.
Yeah. I've also found that, you know, this. I talk about civility towards people who are different, and of course civility can also be used to keep a distance. So, yes, it's a strategy to, you know, maybe a strategy to not engage beyond the civil, but then the question is, would it be better if people actually play their prejudice out in public, or, you know, I don't know.
I mean, I think there's also an interesting question to ask people is not how do you get along, but what do you do when there's a crisis? Mm-hmm. And I think it's precisely when people are placed under constraints of power, where something goes dramatically wrong, like the riots, to see what strategies are then available beyond a kind of common parlance and a happy-go-lucky lingo of whether they're able to constitute some kind of sense of civility beyond the everyday and construct a forum where they're able to voice up to power. I think that is a telltale dimension of diversity that we need to consider more. Can I take some more questions? So in the front and at the back, thank you.
I'm just curious.
Can you say who you are?
Jeffrey Hughes, London School of Economics. I'm just curious what this value of civility looks like, not just to kind of as an analytic concept, but how it's experienced by specifically marginalized groups, people, groups that are criminalized, racialized, perhaps these young black men who everybody's afraid of. What does civility look like to them, and is it a kind of transcendental good, or is it have a more kind of negative valence possibly for certain members of the Hackney community?
Mm. Can we take the other question at the back? Thanks.
Thank you. I'm Nicola Headlam from Liverpool and Oxford. I'm very interested in the way in which place is a character in the ethnography, in the same way that the subjects of the ethnography are. So maybe a word on that. But also, I've written this down, and it's kind of in my head, being kept on the move is a form of violence. I just wonder if you'd like to say something more about that, expand that a bit, because I think that's really, that's sort of really stuck out from these two wonderful talks. Thank you.
Okay. Civility. When it comes to marginalized people, like young black people, I would say there's sort of two, when I talk about civility, I refer to public space mainly and how people behave in public space. And the young black people I spoke to generally emphasized that they didn't experience racism in Hackney public space, but when they left Hackney, they did, when they went to the countryside. But that's very different from institutional racism and from not being able to get jobs, etc. So it's kind of two different levels. One is access to to work and, you know, to a career, which they found more challenging as opposed to their white peers. And the other one is just, you know, being in public space and, you know. Mm-hmm. And then within that public space, of course, there's the issue about how you dress, if you wear, you know, the hoodie and all of that, and this whole appearance of being a group and being, you know, people being scared just because of the way you dress and being stopped and searched by the police just because of the way you dressed, etc.
I don't think young homeless people have much are treated very civilly in the public realm, and that ranges from young men talking about, you know, women grabbing their handbag and crossing the road when they see them, stop and search. I mean, during the time when I was doing this field work, there was a lot of worry about gun and knife crime at the time, and there was a lot of stop and search going on, particularly of young men, particularly young black men. If you're a young homeless person, you're forced into public space a lot more anyway, because you've got no private realm, so you come under these forms of surveillance a lot. So I didn't get the sense of this sort of civil public realm from my research. In terms of being kept on the move as a form of violence, a particular person jumps into my head when I think about that, and he was a young man called, I call him Ryan in the book, and he was trying to train as a plumber, but he was homeless, and every day he had to go to a new someone. He had friends and family in London because he was from London, so he had some networks that he could draw on. But every day he felt like he had to either stay on the bus or go to someone else's house. And he was exhausted, and he was super smart. But I could just see this process wearing him down. And how are you supposed to maintain going to college or a job when you're being kept on the move in that way? So he jumps into my mind when you ask me that question.
Adrian.
I'm Adrian Favell from University of Leeds. So these are grounded ethnographies and highly located London. I'm wondering how specifically British in some ways your ethnographic methodologies and interpretations are. It's kind of interesting that the sorts of theoretical references you're giving are often to social theory and not to ethnographic work in some ways, and I'd be interested if you could sort of situate your work a bit in relation to, say, something like American ethnography, mm-hmm. Kind of work on the one hand, say Elijah Anderson or Amy Meredith Cox, who was presenting in London this weekend. I mean, different types of American ethnographies, where there are quite different distinctions between the kinds of mix of grounded theory and I'd say top-down social theory that you're using.
Just one more question. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Hello, I'm Jane Klosick from Cass Cities at London Metropolitan University. And just to refer back to the previous combination of questions, I wondered, does that mean that there is a certain amount of resources that you need to be able to participate and experience civility? So if you are not able to exercise resources because you don't have any money, then you don't get the civility.
I think the last question, it might go back to Hannah's point, actually, about power and civility and what's going on there, and civility doesn't operate or feel the same for everybody, I suppose. I don't know, what do you think?
Yeah. Sorry. No, I just thought you kind of put the finger on the, what's it called in English?
The buzzer.
That, you know, Emma's ethnography kind of shows that people are subject to, or, you know, aren't able to, you know, don't have the resources to exercise civility in public space, or to receive it especially. Whereas the people I worked with weren't that, I mean, some of them were poor, but I would say that it wasn't related to, I would say resources more in terms of being experienced to be in that place. And that didn't relate to economic resources, but that could be, you know, just, you know, the skill of living in this place for a long time and using public space.
I think that work, for example, with somebody who speaks no English. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, language is a huge issue, but again, I mean, people do manage to communicate. But then now I'm, especially in relation to the new project, I'm talking to a lot of ESOL learners, and it opens up a whole world once they access an English class. And some of them only manage to do so after 20 years of living there because they've been mothers and, you know, all these issues of isolation. So, yes, actually, language is a big issue. But I have been amazed, for example, that I observed this this scene in a supermarket in Sainsbury's of a Turkish woman trying to buy, you know, something and needing help, and the translation was happening over the phone, and it really wasn't a problem. So I think, you know, people manage to get by. I don't want to idealize, you know, it's tough. But I've observed countless situations where people manage to get the kind of meat at the butcher's that they wanted without any English, just by gesturing and stuff. So, you know, I think, yeah, people are very resourceful.
If I could draw in your perspectives, with respect to the question, and maybe refer back to Adrian's question, I wonder if in our work that's so embedded in the UK, if we had to look a little bit more at some of the southern literatures, and particularly someone like Malik Simone, who maybe wouldn't use the lens of civility, but would use the lens of resourcefulness, to take really seriously the kinds of civilities, capacities, strategies that people develop in a context where there is real resource depletion.
Yeah.
And to be much more serious about how those resources elaborate, or that resourcefulness elaborates precisely as power elaborates and becomes more and more opaque, more and more distanced from everyday lives.
Yeah, definitely. I think Abdul Malik Simone does that. It reminds how people manage on the hoof and get by and create things. It reminds me of De Certo's idea of tactics, which I use in the book. This sort of managing on the hoof, which is something I do talk about in the book, although I didn't reference Abdul Malik Simone. But yeah, I think there's a lot to be learned from there, particularly when looking at how groups get by in cities.
Just to get back to Adrian's question, I mean, I do refer to Elijah Anderson and Roger Zanjek and Jennifer Lee, who did work on ethnic businesses in the US. I'm an ethnographer. I did refer to a lot of ethnographies for my own work, and there's been some recent really fascinating work done in New York by someone called Sophia Abdekar, who did research in community gardens. There's been some work in Johannesburg and in Singapore of scholars who looked at the coming together of sort of old diversity with new diversity, where you've had, you know, long established immigrant populations and then newcomers from many different places, and how these different layers sort of interact. Mm. So I think there's a lot of stuff happening in that realm that goes beyond just Europe and Britain.
Yeah, a lot. I read a lot of US ethnographies of homelessness, but it's a very different system. And a lot of the US ethnographies of homelessness very much focus on public space, the right to public space. And what was going on in the UK at the time was quite different. There was this pushing of people into services. And so I was interested in what happens in these indoor spaces. Caroline Knowles' Bedlam on the Streets, which is about Canada, has a focus on mobilities and these interactions with services. One of the best ethnographies I've read this year, which deals with questions of gentrification and diversity, is Lucia Trimber's Coming Up Swinging, which is about a boxing gym in New York. That's absolutely fantastic. So that's something I'll be using in the future.
If you could both expand a little more on Adrian's question with respect to how do you negotiate between what you find in the field and what you find in your literatures? How do you engage this double act that ethnography always demands of theory and the ground?
Well, for me, it was when I went into the field, the theory that I was working with initially just wasn't really working with the ethnography. So I think sometimes in ethnography, you have to learn from the field and then follow the stories and think about why the theory doesn't fit and what might help you understand those situations, rather than just try and apply a theory on a situation.
Mm-hmm. When I came very much from migration research, sort of my PhD was very much focused on transnationalism, and I was based at Compass, at Oxford, etc. So, you know, it was kind of during this whole British discourse of cohesion when that was sort of the dominant discourse on immigration. And I just found this focus on immigration-related diversity and ethnicity, I found it a bit tiring, and I wanted to look at, and especially because I started living in Hackney, and I was like, but this isn't, you know, this, it seems so normal here. So I wanted to just look at what kinds of differences make a difference, what kinds of categorical differences make a difference in people's lives. You know, what are the dividing lines in a place like that? Where, how do people, do they mix across difference? And the only way of finding out was just hanging out with different types of people. But towards the end of the project, I realized that most of the places I was hanging out in, like the parents' groups and the youth club and residence associations and the knitting group, etc., that actually most of these people had been living in the area for a long time and that the new migrants were missing. So in some ways, this the research on diversity, almost sort of the recent immigration, suddenly I realized it fell out of the picture. So now I'm working on a project that goes back towards migration research, looking at these recent migrants and how they settle into a place that is already very mixed.
Yeah, Tim Thomas, I'm a youth justice worker from South London. Question for Suzanne. In terms of your research, where would it fit with, say, Butler's idea of tectonic social relations? Your research seems more hopeful in terms of people are relating in the public and the parochial realms. It's just the private is largely left alone, whereas Butler seems to suggest that people are missing each other and just kind of nod heads. An interesting point to the lady at the end, sorry, I can't remember your name, interested about when pressure comes on diverse communities. I just wonder whether super diversity actually assists the peaceful resolving in a, for example, in Birmingham when the riots came, we nearly had World War III, when there were two very kind of large communities that came into conflict. Where the communities are much smaller, maybe it makes for an easy resolving, maybe there's less tension, I don't know. So.
Should I answer it now? Yeah. Very much so, I think. I mean, there's different issues that I mentioned in terms of contestations of space, but also housing allocation, which in Bethnal Green, for example, where you have much clearer divisions between communities, between the Bangladeshis and the white British and the Somalis, and these issues are much more sort of negotiated or fought over in these ethnic terms. But in a place that is so mixed, you can't, I mean, one of the counselors I spoke to, when I asked him what kinds of issues people approach him with and whether they blame it on specific groups, he goes, well, you don't know who to blame it on because everybody's different and people don't know, you know. So I think there is something about the picture being so mixed and so many small groups that you can't, that these divisions don't come up that clearly. And the issue why the hipsters or the gentrifiers are perceived as the other is that that change happened very quickly. The in-movement of the professionals happened in a very short amount of time, and it was visible and noticeable, and it fell together with huge regeneration projects as part of the Olympics. So I think something happened there that was suddenly, you know, when I asked people about changes in the population of the area, nobody talked about immigrants, but everybody talked about the professionals. So it's not immigration-related diversity, but it's actually gentrification, which is the main issue, and that is a visible group of people. Yeah.
Something about hipsters. I think there is also no. It's like we say hipsters, and then everyone laughs because it's middle class. If you're middle class and white, you can feel like, oh, at least I'm not a hipster. And I think in some recent research I did, somebody said to me, you know, if you're on the East London line and you can't see a hipster, you're the hipster. So I think we have to think about these figures as being like constitutive others for the middle class as well, and what the hipster category does.
I'd like to...
Yes, I'm Shirley Ford from the West of London doing the research on health, housing and social care. My issue is the two things mentioned by the speakers in terms of something called panicked multiculturalism. In reference to what the other mentioned as super diversities, referred to the last question. Do any of the speakers really believe in terms of the desperation, crisis, riots, and regeneration, or so-called gentrification we've had in the past 20 years? How has this really helped the inner city cultures in terms of policy making? And do they believe that the process we have at the moment has really begun to challenge such dislocation?
I think the policies we've got at the moment are only exacerbating those things that you talked about. I think Suzanne's maybe more hopeful than I am in general, so I don't know if you want to.
I'm an optimist. No, I'm hopeful in terms of how people get on with it on the ground with each other. I'm not very hopeful in terms of service provision and dismantling of the welfare state and all of that. And what the book is really about is more about, you know, how people sort of manage to get on in this kind of context.
Thank you, Fran.
Fran Tonkis, LSE. I wanted to pick up on something which Suzanne mentioned a few minutes ago, and which was exactly the term that was running through my mind, which is the differences that make a difference. I find the concept of superdiversity incredibly useful and suggestive in opening up how we think about social differences along lines beyond, you know, conventional sociological categories in particular. And yet, you know, one of the things that's emerged in the research that you've both undertaken and in your books is that there are these very stubborn intersections around very well-established differences around age, around race, around gender. I mean, you mentioned that young black men as being particularly... I mean, I'm sure that the young black men in your study also enjoy the pleasures of diversity in various ways, but you could have made that statement 25 years ago, 30 years ago. So, I want to sort of value the contribution discourses of superdiversity make to our understandings of social change and social relationships. And yet some of these very long-standing categorizations and classifications just continue to have their grip on certain members of social groups.
They really do. I mean, the reason I found superdiversity useful in the beginning was I thought it makes sense if you go into a homeless centre, yes, you can talk about ethnic difference, but some of the differences that really make a difference in access to services, a difference around migration status and all those things, and I thought superdiversity gave me a way to think through that. I've become a little more disenchanted with it as a term, I have to say, because I worry that it flattens and I worry that it doesn't pay enough attention to those things that you were talking about, but I guess maybe it's how you use it. So I'm undecided whether to throw it in the dustbin or keep persevering with it.
Thanks for that. I think it helps us, if we use it as a lens, it helps us to go to our field sites and not start off with, I'm going to research class differences in this area, or I'm going to research ethnic differences or whatever. But as I said, to look at what kinds of difference make a difference. If it then turns out that it's still class, it's still race, it's still, then that tells us something about what's happening or what's not happening, what should be happening. So I think, you know, it's useful to sort of let go of researching specific categories and just letting them emerge from the ground.
I think what's also crucial in the potential of super diversity is not only what's happening on the ground amongst people living their lives, but what's happening amongst policymakers. And I think if you had to kind of really read through the Immigration Act of 2014, it's become immensely elaborate. It's diversifying in all sorts of really unpleasant ways. It's permeating every sector of public and private life. And I think in order to take the term really seriously, we have to look at the diversification of regulation and power structures as well, and how they impinge in new and important ways on people's prospects.
That's true, but also we were talking earlier about how racism runs through those acts and who's allowed in the country and who isn't allowed in the country.
But there, again, on a more positive note, The Hackney Council really picked that term up, superdiversity. They liked it. And they kind of opened up their perspective and realized, oh, we can't think along these old categories of ethnicities. We need to look actually, who else is here? And what problems are there? What other problems or groups are there in the boroughs that we need to pay attention to? And they found that actually homophobia is one of the main issues, apart from they're very aware of the issue about black youth, but homophobia was sort of second on the list. And I thought that, you know, it was actually helpful for them, even if they maybe use it in simplified terms, but still it kind of opened up a new perspective.
I was going to say, though, isn't...
Oh, but Hannah is the expert.
Yeah, I was going to say, though, isn't... I can see why as a council, superdiversity would be attractive, because it's very malleable and it sounds quite fluffy.
So two more questions, the last two questions. Hannah and...
Socioeconomic equality, the council is recognised as a massive issue, and that's why I'm trying to talk about some of that civility smooths over some of those bigger structural issues and goes, well, we all get along, even though some of us can't get jobs or
Thanks.
Malik Gul, Imperial College London. I think the issue that you raised around systems and structures, I think, is an interesting one, and the spaces where diversity doesn't exist. I mean, the vast majority of our public institutions, ALESI, elsewhere, are hideously white organizations. You might talk about Hackney, and you might say that Hackney wants to look at diversity in a different kind of way, but the people who are looking at it are essentially white, middle class people. And I think that you can't divorce the issues of racism and power from this. I mean, people are tweeting here, and if you go on Twitter and they talk about the whiteness of this particular conversation, and you know, the irony doesn't pass me by that we're talking about diversity with a non-diverse panel. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you look at a lot of our communities, black communities, poor communities, disengaged communities, that for them the issue of diversity is not a passive process. It's something that actively immobilizes them by the hideous whiteness of our institutions. So there's an uncomfortableness about this debate where we're almost kind of exploiting communities. We go into communities, we take from them to write our report and our research and so on and so forth, and then leave these communities in the passive state which they're in. And there's an uncomfortableness about that, because you're not doing nothing to help and support the communities in Hackney and the ones who are being... So perhaps that's an academic lens, and perhaps we're in an academic institution, there's something uncomfortable about the nature of this debate.
I think you're right, and that's why we need to talk about race still. You know, we could say this is a wonderfully super diverse panel because we're all from different countries. Now, that would gloss, you know, and gloss white privilege, which we all benefit from. So you're absolutely right, and we need to talk about race in universities and how that operates. I absolutely agree. There's another question about what we do as researchers in terms of communities and what we give back to the groups we're working with or not. I don't know about Suzanne's position. Yeah, I'm very aware of that. I get to leave that space. I have done stuff since with that centre, and I've tried to be useful in ways that I can in terms of getting the arguments out there. I've kept up my contact with that organisation, and we do things together sometimes. But yeah, I take your point.
Yeah, good point. But also, I think things are a bit more complicated than that. And I'm glad you mentioned that, you know, we're not all the same. We come from different countries.
No, but I was saying it's important to think about race.
Yeah, I was just going to get to that. I think, you know, we've both tried to very much sort of, you know, emphasize, and there's a whole chapter on this in my book, that race is still one of the main dividing issues or, you know, issues of inequality, but at the same time, things have gone a bit more complicated, and I've encountered a lot of people as part of the new project who might be white, but extremely disadvantaged because of their immigration background. They might be from Chechnya or Uzbekistan, they might be undocumented. And, you know, I've encountered white people who have experienced a lot of discrimination because they didn't speak the language. So I think it's important to also include these other sort of types of inequalities that are related to being a newcomer or having a difficult legal status, etc. To also look at that sort of through that lens.
Massive discrimination against particular types of communities. And if we keep moving the agenda on, oh, what about the Ukrainians, or what about the Belarusians, and so on and so forth, we actually miss the point about power and structural control.
Well, that's, I guess I've talked about that in my presentation, that that's the one community that was left out of the picture in Hackney.
But I think you raise an important point, and I think precisely in understanding primary conditions of structural racism and inequality making, in paying serious attention to that, it maybe gives us a way of seeing new and emerging discriminations. And I think we can't rub those away either, that, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of people trying to get through borders who are having to live in very compromised ways, and particularly when they enter a system in the UK where there is such kind of vehement forms of discrimination, it means that their entry points are already preconditioned. So I think it is in paying attention to the primary sources that we then understand the secondary, tertiary waves of inequality making that are heading our way. Yeah, I think that's an absolutely valid point. On that note, I would like to ask Suzanne and Emma to reflect on a fundamental concern that the power structures are becoming, I think, a lot more pervasive since 2008, that there are increasing forms of inequality, that there are expanding practices of paranoia making. And the noose around the neck of ordinary lives, or what we might want to call resourcefulness, is tightening. So with this issue and question in mind, what would be the thoughts that you would like to leave the audience with in terms of the role of critical urban ethnography in opening up a perhaps more responsible or engaged ethnographic imagination? I know it's a really light, easy question, so... But or even if you want to just reflect on a new research project that you're undertaking that you think would advance some of the imminent concerns.
Okay, I'll talk a little bit about the research that I was working on with Hannah, who's here, and a whole host of researchers. And we were looking precisely at anti-immigration government campaigns, but looking very, this is where I think ethnography can come in. We were looking at how they unfolded on the ground in different localities, and forms of resistance and responses to these top-down things. They unfolded very differently in different places, and that's where ethnography can come in, I think, to examine these sort of close-up local stories and look at how these big incursions from the state impact differently on different places and people.
And do you think it has political purchase? So, for instance, I know you took some of your research findings to... the House of Parliament.
There was people there with Home Office lanyards, but they were quite quiet. So I don't know. What do you know?
I think we just sent something to the select committee.
Yeah.
We sent something to the select committee. We don't know if they'll.
Yeah.
But actually, maybe not by the government, but NGOs have said. Mm. Having that analysis, having that evidence is really useful for them in campaigning. So that kind of political purchase. ethnography and that kind of research can be helpful.
Yeah, it can be. And it doesn't have to be just, you know, we developed that research with civil society groups. So what they thought was useful research actually fed into that whole process. That's another way that we can make ourselves useful as ethnographers.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think all we can do is try and feed back to local governments, national governments, very much trying to do that and to sort of have some kind of relationship with the policymakers on the ground. And I'm not so sure about media engagement, because you never know how you're going to get interpreted and how, you know, whether it's going to be a simplified picture. But I think, you know, what I've noticed with Hackney Council and local organisations is that, you know, they often said, oh, you know, this is exactly the kind of research we can't do. We don't have the time to speak, to talk to people. So maybe we can contribute by doing exactly that.
Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us, and you're very... Welcome to have a glass of wine with us outside. Thank you.